Apologies from the floor.
To an apology from Councillor Quinn.
Councillor Quinn, Councillor Sharon.
And Eddie Curtis as well.
Eddie Curtis. Okay, any declarations of interest? No. Okay, action sheets. Go through for accuracy. Page 1, page 2, page 3. Page 4, I would like to raise just asking for an update on the terms of reference for the big screen, specifically an update on the audit process and when we can expect an update on that.
Yep. Thank you, Chair. My understanding is that our ASM, our internal auditors, have now concluded their review. I'm scheduled to have a conference call with them tomorrow to start the closeout process that goes with any internal audit review, and I would hope then that we will receive a draft report very shortly. It would be our intention, and we have an audit committee on the 27th of this month, and it's my expectation that we'll be in a position to bring a draft report to that audit committee for consideration.
Thanks, Dorina. Can I request that that report be circulated to members of the audit committee well in advance, or in as advance as possible, so that we have a good chance to review that in detail?
Yep, we can do that, Chair.
Okay, thank you. Page 5 on the action sheet, page 6, page 7, page 8, and page 9. Okay, no issues. Item 4. Oh, just before we move on, item 8, the management accounts. I'm going to take those just after item 13. Sorry, Robert.
Well, Chairman, thanks for sending me out that email. But the other day, that email is the old email about this Stainfield project, right?
Mm-hmm.
I have spoken to the three guys, and they said they never received that email. And you said that them three guys were in agreement with the 10-point plan, which they are not. But you said that they got an email, so I would like a copy of the email that they got. Is that possible for you to get me that? Whoever sent it to them, because they said they never seen it.
Right.
One guy said he seen it the day afterwards, but he definitely was not in agreement to the 10-point plan. There were 3 points drew up at that first meeting, belonging to the Stainfield group. So I'm wanting to know the truth, where this 10-point plan come from. And so does Hapo Stainfield. And who put that 10-point plan together, because it should never have appeared.
Okay.
And we were told that those three guys agreed to it, and they did not. So I'm wanting you to sort this out once and for all.
Robert, you do realise the 10-point plan was whittled down to the 3-point plan that you're talking about? Right. But the 10-point plan is redundant now, because it hasn't been taken forward. The 10-point plan was every conceivable option, which has now been whittled down to 3 points, which we've gone out to collect a business case for. Right. I've shown you the email that was sent out with the 10-point plan, though. Who? Who are these three guys? These are the three guys that signed the second proposal, I think, the one that went forward for business case. Right, okay. Okay.
I know where this is coming from.
Yeah.
When it was raised at the start in relation to the 10-point plan, yes, it was whittled down to three. There was initially three, right? It ended up coming to the desk of the director with 10 points on it. Now, you did turn around and say that, you know, at the time at the meeting in relation to this 10-point plan that you had emailed, that you had sent the email. That's what Councillor Burgess asked for at the time, right? Then when he didn't get it after a number of weeks, he'd asked again, and then you ended up saying that that was then, you had said, was sent by, I think it was Mr. Scarlett that had sent that email, or that group, you know, in St. Phila sent that. That's what Councillor Burgess, I think, is wanting clarified. Now, you originally yourself had said that you sent that email. So that's what Councillor Burgess, I think, is wanting clarified.
I think there's a cross wire there. There was a second proposal which dealt with the free
the three proposals that we sent out a business case for, that was sent by Damien Scarlett, the fellows you're referring to, I think, five people in the community who represent.
You told this committee mm-hmm. three questions. That was when I stopped with the question. Mm-hmm. Your proposal is yes, mm-hmm. And that was not right. And that's something the chair.
But those three had not been consulted on that. I was under the impression through the Sinfield Trust Working Committee that all of those people had been consulted, Robert. Right, okay, well. Sorry? What would they be getting blamed for? Because the 10-point plan turned into the 3-point plan we've taken forward. Right, okay, we'll let you have the last word on that one, Robert. I'm still not 100% sure on that, but you fine? I really don't think it will. Item 4, Statement of Community Involvement. Oh, sorry, that report has been withdrawn due to... Yeah, due to late additions. Item 5, then. Andrew?
Thank you, Chair. The paper before committee is the Local Development Plan Preparatory Study, Paper 12, Part 2, Countryside Development Pressure Analysis. As for previous papers, members will be aware that this paper is part of an ongoing programme of preparatory work for the Local Development Plan. The preparatory studies provide members with an overview of various planning-related topic areas in the district and are essential in providing the evidence base for preparing the plan. The purpose of these preparatory studies and this topic paper is set out in the covering report. Paper 12, which is attached, provides members with a report on the development pressure analysis for the countryside of the district. This analysis forms an integral part of the development plan process and forms one of the four interrelated strands of the countryside assessment, the other strands being landscape assessment, environmental assets appraisal and a settlement appraisal. Members will recall that the landscape character assessment paper was reported to the committee last month, and before that we previously reported the environment assets paper. I can also advise that work is ongoing in respect of the settlement appraisal exercise. One of the aims of the local development plan will be to balance development in the countryside against the need to protect the district's most vulnerable landscapes. The development pressure analysis seeks to identify areas where significant development pressure has occurred and where local character, rural character is under threat of significant change. Much of this analysis involves assessing the distribution of single dwellings in the countryside, and some areas of our district would be considered to be under more pressure than others. Some will be more resilient to the pressure of that development, but overall the issue that will need to be addressed is whether such development is sustainable. The information gathered and the key findings set out in the paper will inform the preparation of the local development plan, and members asked to note the report and paper. Happy to take any comments. Thanks, Chair.
Thanks, Andrew. Thanks. I have some concerns about this. Whilst I'm very keen to maintain the character of the landscape, I'm also aware that a lot of people who qualified in developing policies in this area graduated in UK universities, and they're advised by what goes on in England and Scotland and Wales. Now, there's a unique situation here in Ireland where we didn't have the same feudal processes that went through the reduction in commonage in England, or indeed the widespread ethnic cleansing in Scotland, which removed the rural population from most of the Scottish countryside. In Scotland and England, of course, we have a situation where we have very distinct boundaries to villages, whereas in Ireland, generally, we have dispersed rural communities. Places like Leitrim or places like Annacloy, where we have people living in a townland that stretches over a considerable distance that can't be easily defined by a single boundary. It's because we didn't have the sort of population movements that occurred in Scotland and in England. So one has to be extremely careful about transposing norms that are appropriate from one country to another. In particular, the whole tradition of clachan in Ireland is extremely important, of groups of small houses together grouped within the countryside. So I'd just be concerned that we would throw the baby out with the bathwater, and I would like to see where in the document the notion proposed rural living is contained and where the notion of Clachan is contained. And finally, just to pick up on the area of renewable energy, clearly the farming community and family farms are under considerable pressure around with the world in general. But in this area, where we have a lot of smaller farms, the opportunities to arise from a diversification of farm income through renewable energy is an extremely potential and potent source of additional income on family farms. So I want to make sure that we don't end up transposing norms that might be perfectly acceptable in Britain that actually don't reflect the way in which Irish people live in this country. So could you show me or explain to me how you're going to tackle those three areas?
Well, first of all, maybe I'm part of the ethnic cleansing from Scotland that you referred to, and since I'm now residing in Northern Ireland. But in terms of the issues you raised, obviously the planning policy that's been developed in Northern Ireland, yes, has to a degree reflected the policy that's been developed in England, Wales, and indeed Scotland. But obviously it's then been adapted to more suit the Northern Ireland context. Dispersed rural communities is addressed in PPS 21. It was in the draft strategic planning policy statement, but then was removed from the finalised version. But what the SPPS does state is that policy approaches to new development in the country should reflect differences within the region and need to be sensitive to local needs. And obviously that gives scope for sort of local councils to, in the development of their own strategies and policies, look at their own particular sort of sensitivities in terms of local needs that apply to the district. In terms of when we take things forward in any sort of countryside strategy, obviously we'll take into consideration the nature of the sort of rural development that's taking place within the district, particularly in South Armagh, where you have more scattered and more examples of dispersed rural communities. The Clachan is a good example in terms of that would give you opportunities to look at maybe a more clustering of development. But the issue here that's been raised in this paper is just looking at maybe some of the situation that has taken place over the past number of years, going back to 2002, and seeing how the effect of sporadic one-off houses in the countryside has impacted on our countryside. And we need to be very careful there in terms of how we balance that impact on the landscape, the landscape that is also critically important to as an asset for tourism. So, you know, obviously there's a balance that needs to be struck, and really this paper aims to inform how we deal with that development pressure.
Okay. No other questions? We'll move on to item.
Your view on the trend in the numbers has been downwards in all of the DAs, maybe with the exception of one. Rowallan, I think, is seeing an increase, or certainly a steady. Has that been, do you think, policy driven, or has it been the recession that has driven the reductions? And do we need to be looking at policy? If it is a recession, it's been driving up.
It's a combination of both. Obviously, you'll see in the report we have given a sort of timeline of where the various rural policies come in. Obviously, the more stringent policies that came in with PPS 21 in 2010, you can see that between 2002 up to 2009 in the report across the district. There was over 10,000 new dwellings approved. In the last 6 to 7 years since the introduction of PPS 21, which obviously introduced a lot more control in respect of single houses in the countryside, there's just over 3,500. But obviously, round about the same time as we're sort of in the 2006-2007, there was an issue in terms of the economic downturn, which again also has had an impact in terms of the level of number of applications that were coming forward in respect of single houses. So it has been a combination, but I think the major factor in terms of the reduced numbers has probably been the introduction of PPS 21. But even with that, you can see that there are areas which are still would seem to be taking a fair number of applications compared with others. We've sought to detail that on a DEA basis, and then some DEAs would appear to be maybe more resilient to accepting that pressure than others.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Mark, go ahead.
Where PPS 21 seems to be doing the job that it was designed to do, will your focus then maybe on taking up on actual design of the properties that have been built within the, particularly the ANOBs?
Obviously, this paper will look at the design of the opportunity for us to
thanks, Chair. I think Mark sort of touched on it in regards to the design of dwellings in the countryside. I think it's something that as a council moving forward, we need to take a keen interest. We are, areas of outstanding natural beauty. And there's some monstrosities have been built right across the council area. So I think it's important that we look at, and while there is a design guide for PPS 21, I think it's maybe an opportunity to have our own design guides in regards to moving forward and in consultation with architects and the agents and get a firm commitment that all parties will endeavour to move or stay within the confines of that design guide. I think it's an opportunity to do that. The other issue is, I suppose, is about the restoration of dwellings that's already in the countryside. Instead of building, new dwellings, I think we should be looking at restoring the old buildings, that is scattered throughout our rural area. The other issue, I suppose, and where people on the planning committee are well aware of, it's usually a farm dwelling and a dispute about clustering with the farm dwellings. Versus health and safety of the person going to live, the family going to live in that home, and being too close to the farm. I think it's something, I'm not sure if it's this is the opportunity to do that, to look at that, but to get some sort of guideline that suits everybody's purpose in regards to trying to cluster, integrate, but also to allow families to be safe in their home. And there's always ambiguity in regards to infill dwellings. I think we maybe need, a clearer policy in regards to that.
No, I'd take the last point first. No, I would agree that there is certainly, in terms of obviously being chair of the planning committee, councillor, you were aware of some of the issues that particularly arise in respect of interpretation of PPS 21. Yes, in certain elements there is more clarification required, and there will be an opportunity for the council in developing our own local policies to give that extra layer, and that could also apply to design. Replacement dwellings, you might have picked up in terms of one of the statistics within this paper, is that you know, all these approvals, you know, 14,000 approvals in the last 15 years, 36 of them would be regarded as replacements. So a third would be considered to be replacement dwellings. In terms of the design, obviously the department, obviously we have to take account of design guidance that has been issued. The design guide that you refer to is certainly one of the more recent design guides, and it's certainly one that has been was developed by the department and working with architects and obviously the those that have an interest in the rural communities, and certainly it's a design guide that has been sort of fairly well received, and certainly I think it's one that we can still use and work with. There is an opportunity again for any some supplementary design guides, particularly to Newry Moreland Down. Certainly in the past there was a small design guide even for the Moorns area, you know, so these things have existed in the past, and there would be an opportunity you know, certainly to look at other sort of design guide that is more particular to this district.
Michael?
Thank you, Chair. Thanks, Hanley, for that. I'm just wondering about the total number that, of approvals that we give for development over the... Sorry. No, am I kidding you?
No.
The total number, I think there's 13,500 approvals there. I think in total we only have something like 60,000 dwellings in the whole of this district. Is that not an enormous approval rate?
I'm not too sure about the numbers of dwellings in the district. I know certainly the rural population is about 60,000 of the rural population, which is about 35% of the district's population. So, you know, just over a third of the district's population would be residing in the countryside. I think that certainly the you know, when these figures were first produced, you know, to think that nearly 15,000 single houses have been approved in the countryside since 2002, that's the size of a medium-sized town in a Northern Ireland context. And, you know, and when you put it in that context, I think that amplifies the number of houses that have physically been approved in this district.
The
population hasn't really sort of grown significantly. It's grown marginally over the years, but you know, you might find that certainly a number of those houses in the countryside where there's been sons and daughters of those already residing in the rural community, be it where farmers that you know, have then obviously got their own house. So there's no change to the you know, the household size. The household's just been split up into a different number of houses. You know, so there is that factor, and certainly a lot of the houses in the countryside would be certainly some of the farm dwellings have been for sons and daughters of families or other relations in respect of the farming community.
Okay. Andrew, thank you very much. Item 6, quarterly policy screening report. Regina?
Mr. Chairman, all policies the Council is proposed to adopt must be equality screened prior to implementation to assess if there's any impact on the promotion of equality of opportunity and good relations. This report is just for noting. We are obliged as part of our commitments under equality scheme to actually publish our policy screenings on a quarterly basis on our website. This quarterly report covers the period January to March 2017, and it's only for noting. Thank you
very much. Item 7, Book of Condolence Policy. Eileen?
Yep. The Book of Condolence, as you know, councillors, on occasions the council makes available books of condolence in our premises. The attached draft policy, which you have in front of you, has been considered at a recent meeting of the Party Representatives Forum, and it aims to standardise arrangements for the books of condolence. So we're seeking your agreement to proceed with this.
Close, Councillor Doran. Second, Councillor Andrews. Michael's on.
Yeah, Chair. I did read it over before the meeting. I just think it lacked some detail. There's not an awful lot of guidance in it to our chair or chief executive exactly when we should have a book of condolence set it up. We're really, the policy is simply saying that it's down to the chair and the chief executive. Now, I'm not objecting to that, but there's no guidance to them. And I'm just wondering that sometime in the future, will we be putting those two individuals in some sort of a position? It tells us how the book will be laid out, how it will be bound, who it will go to, and where it will be located, and so on. But there's no guidance. It's not saying that there should be some connection to this council district, or the person should be recognised throughout Ireland or internationally, or whether it's a disaster. You know, and there are so many disasters in the world. I just wonder, have we given this enough attention? For the safeguards of our chair and our chief executive in the future, because we're putting a whole lot onto their heads. Thank you, Chair.
Just in reply to Councillor Carr, we did exactly the same debate as you're raising here, and we thought that it's just so broad, and I mean, no one can see what occasions are going to arise in the future that a book of condolence may be open, and it would be difficult to put parameters to it, as you discussed. We thought that the chair and the chief executive did discuss it along with Colin Moffat, the head of policy, and we thought that perhaps the code of conduct for councillors would be of assistance to the chairperson, and the code for employees would be of assistance to the chief executive, and that really the chairperson would consider the occasions as they arise and would attempt then to he may well react to public contact to her as to when to go. We just thought it would be a very difficult thing to attempt to put in black and white and quantify, but maybe Liam would like to expand on that as well, on the book of condolence and putting more detail around when books would be open is what Councillor Carr's requiring about.
Willie, Mines?
Yeah.
I appreciate it. It's a difficult one to get right, to cover all bases in regards to who makes the decision and what protocols are used to make that decision and what ground rules are made. I think it's important councillors need to be mindful when they're making requests that it is it is a huge honour to open up the book of condolence, and it's a huge mark of respect. And you don't want it to be turned into a political football. There's dangers of other councils where that's actually happening at the minute. I think it was in regards to Martin McGuinness about opening the book and the council and the chair of the council didn't want to open the book. You know, and that causes friction and difficulties. I suppose it has to be, it has to be reminded that the chair is acting in the capacity for all the citizens and representing the council, the corporate body of council. So if a request was made, you would expect it to take it in good faith, that it would be respected. Just in regards to the issue about you know, where the locations for the books of condolence would be. I'm conscious here that the two main towns, or large city and town, is the areas that are being suggested. I just think it creates difficulties for people living in the likes of Newcastle, living in the likes of maybe Warren Point, about travelling, having to travel in to sign the book of condolence. And I think it would be more appropriate to have maybe a paper brought back, or I don't want to stall the process, but in regards with two areas of John Patrick for signing the book, and then with two areas in Uri to sign the book, is there a need for that to happen? That's my first point. And could it not be spread then into two other towns? You know, likes of Uri, or likes of Warren Point, and maybe the likes of Newcastle.
There's no reason why not. The other thing we would like to do, I don't think we maybe have the capacity at the minute, but we would like in due course, if we had the website, we'd like to be able to let people find these online, really.
Mm, that's a good idea.
Chair, maybe to pick up the issues is, you know, I suppose the other thing is too is in terms of location. We supported the RNLI set up the Book of Condolence in the garden 116, on that basis then we supported that there, which were held in Newcastle Sea Faring locations. In terms of that location, I suppose it's where you stop and where you start. The reason for two locations in Uri and Dunpatrick is, well, first of all, Dunpatrick, the city both our locations are out of the town centres, so to have them at the town halls and at the arts centre was so people could walk into it if they're in shopping and stuff like that there, because that's part of the rationale for that. I suppose in terms, the issue is that it's, I suppose when you elect the first citizen, you know, the first citizen is the voice for the council, and but I do appreciate that person also wants to take guidance. My role is the head of paid service, and also in terms of policy, that I will be akin to equality issues and other issues in terms that needs to be done. And so that's the purpose of the two named individuals in terms of open the book of condolences. But, you know, we have had requests to open the book of condolences, which we haven't opened, and this, you know, but the chairperson of both during the last term and during this term. It's very, very hard. You know, you could be opening book. The other issue is you could be opening book of condolences on a weekly basis. You know, if you currently look at what's happening across the world, you know, you could be. So again, there has to be some sort of a political position onto it, and also a political civic type position into it. And again, a point of view in terms that if we felt that it was an issue that from a civic point of view, that I could give advice on that basis. But it's a very difficult one. It's where, you know, everyone will be coming forward. And again, you want us back to, I think, Councillor Clark's point that he made was, we've also got to understand that opening the Book of Condolence is a particularly significant event for the council. And if you have it that you're opening on an every week basis, you're not giving that significance to it.
Okay. Thanks, Liam.
No, Chair, just the reason I'm saying the council is an extremely big council area. It's extremely rural. We touched on it earlier on. For people, to expect people to travel from the likes of, you know, Kilcoo, Dundrum, and you know, and Glasdrum, and Ballymartin, and Newcastle, you know, to travel away to Dunpatrick on public transport to sign a book of condolence, you know, it's a big endeavour. That's all I'm trying to say. And if there was maybe areas, pick two towns where they were more central, I think it makes sense. At least people then, you know, can make their way into that. It might be a 5-mile journey, 4-mile journey. It's not a, you know, a 15-mile journey. So I just think it's common sense to have somewhere in the middle.
Chair, I'm not adverse to Councillor Clark saying. I suppose I'm certainly we could look at, you know, maybe bring back and agree the principles in the Book of Condolences. We could look at, two things you need to be doing. If you open a book on loans, you have to have a venue that people can come into and it's private and they can sit down and do it. So people need to look at that. Also, Councillor Burns sitting here beside me, and, you know, I'm sure Crossford Glen, why would you not do it in Crossford Glen as well? So then do you do it in Saintfield, you know, in terms of, and then the problem is where do you get to occasions, and some of the, you have a community centre in Crossford Glen. So can we maybe look at some way if members could be happy in the first instance? Please God, we're not opening any book of condolences, and you know, in the next month or so, if we brought back looking at sort of locations, maybe some rationale whereby we could look at, say, Warren Pines or Kilkeel or Newcastle or Saintfield or Crossford Glen, and maybe look at some sort of way that we could actually give it a more even spread and look at some of the locations, because again, we've set out there what we want in terms of book of condolences. So if members are happy with the protocol, that we can pick that up, pick up locations, maybe, and come back to you with more details on that.
I think it's already covered in the policy anyway, Liam, where it says that you can in effect do that. Both the chief executive and the chair can extend the number of locations that there are in the district. So it's probably already covered.
Okay. I don't mean to come back in, sure. I think that's for just the point that Liam outlined, you know, in regards to the Coast Guard helicopter disaster. And that was a special sort of condition. You know, it was a seaworthy town that they were looking at. And Newcastle, obviously, there was no cooperation between the lifeboat and the Coast Guard in Newcastle with the Coast Guard helicopter. Justin. No, if you're looking for proposals, I propose, as long as we look at the, you know, the locations.
Well, Councillor Dorn and Councillor Andrews proposed and seconded, but we can take that away and look at it, Eileen, if that's all right. Okay, all agreed. Item 8, we're going to take after item 13, just we take all the closed session items together and save Brian having to get up and come back in again. So, item 9, anti-fraud policy, and Serena, yeah.
Thank you, Chair. Members, you have in front of you tonight three new policies, an anti-fraud policy, and then separately a fraud response plan, which underpins that, and then a new whistleblowing policy. We do have policies in place currently in Council, but you'll be aware it's good practice to update these regularly, taking on board any best practice guidance. What's more important than actually just having the policies in place is ensuring that all our staff are appropriately trained and briefed, understanding both their responsibilities to report any suspicions of fraud and also the protections afforded to them under whistleblowing legislation should they be in a position to do so. We've worked closely with the Northern Ireland Audit Office in developing these, and you'll see at point two that they've actually offered some assistance to us in delivering the training of staff. So we're asking tonight for your approval to introduce these new policies and roll out a programme of training to staff and council. Thank you.
Councillor Andrews. Go ahead, thank you, please. Proposed, Councillor Ryan.
I'll go second, but out of practice, no, I think it's very essential that we do have these policies in place to more or less protect the way the council does its business and the public money and so on is accounted for. But in relation to whistleblowing, over the past lot of years, we've heard tales of whistleblowers and other organisations, such as the National Health Service, being victimised and being ostracised because they had the courage to stick their heads above the parapet to reveal wrongdoings that were going on, and they felt that need highlighted. And despite protestations that nothing happened to you, they ended up, they felt worse than what the perpetrators of the deeds were done. And I'm just wondering, in this case, would we be 100%? Would we ensure, could we guarantee that if anybody that was in a position to whistleblow as such, you know, would they be 100% protected? You know, I'm not implying anything, but will the council stand by them 100% to ensure that they're not ostracised or feel victimised because they stood by their conscience?
Yeah. Councillor, I suppose my experience in this area would be that a lot of that comes from the culture and the tone within the organisation, and there is a legislative framework that gives us responsibility to protect people who do feel that they need to blow the whistle. One of the things you'll note there in section 2 is that when we're rolling out the training, we are going to ensure that a member of the senior management team introduces that, because it's very important that that message is driven down to all our staff, that the tone at the top is that those protections will be afforded to staff as far as possible in the circumstances. Very difficult to give a 100% guarantee, but certainly the tone and the culture that we want to ensure our staff are aware of is one of protection under the legislation.
Okay. Moving on, item 10, scheme of delegation. Liam's going to take it.
Chairman, is there for approval. I'm not going to have a detail on it.
Yeah, no problem. That's just for, it's just for noting, or do you need a...
I need a proposal second, because the decision's already taken by the director. So just to accept the decisions.
Yeah. Councillor Clark on Dorn. Item 11, Councillor Allowances.
Thank you, Chair. Just to bring to your attention for noting, councillors, the Department for Communities have proposed certain changes to councillors' allowance, which they intend to bring into the revised guidance once the regulations are in a position to be made. Obviously, just with the current lack of executive, those regulations are somewhat delayed. You have in front of you there a number of bullet points which the department are now drawing to your attention as proposed changes to the guidance. We do have the opportunity to comment. I know these have been brought through the finance working group, and I believe they've been brought through the NIC working group as well. So really just to highlight these to your attention, and obviously in due course we will be following those guidance.
I know one of those bullet points is referred to as Schedule 1 and 2 without giving any detail of what Schedule 1 and 2 are about. Be relevant to us, and we need to know.
Yeah, Schedule 1 and 2 are the travel and subsistence schedules, which you'll recall the department issued a circular in February 17, and we actually brought that to the last committee to you. So it's really, I think, the department's trying to bring all of the all of the alliances together into one set of regulations. So Schedules 1 and 2 are the travel and subsistence, which we highlighted to you at the last committee meeting.
Okay. Thanks, Rena. That is just for noting. So move on to item 12, correspondence from Department for Infrastructure. Are you taking that as well? Liam, are you taking that one?
Again, Chairman, it's a consultation document. We're happy to take any points on it. You know, that anyone wants to raise with us, you know, it's regarding environment and impact assessment, you know.
Yeah, so it's just for noting, so if there's no
or
questions.
If any members want to comments, we can incorporate them in the council response. But
no problem. So no comments, we'll go on. Item 13, motion from Councillor Riley. It has not been withdrawn by Councillor Riley. He's been asked that it is deferred to a future meeting of SPNR, as he was unable to make this meeting. I'm happy to entertain his motion at the next meeting. Obviously not incredibly urgent, as he was away on holiday the first time he came forward and couldn't make it again today, but I am happy enough that it is discussed at next month's meeting. Okay, so item 8 and then the following items are all in closed session. So, what's item 8? This item is deemed to be restricted by virtue of paragraph 3 of part 1 of Schedule 6 of the Local Government Act, Northern Ireland 2014, information relating to the financial or business affairs of any particular person, including the council holding that information. Can I get a proposer to go into committee, please? Councillor Burns, seconded Councillor Enright. Yeah. Get the same one. No problem. Thanks. Okay. For the record, while in committee, item 8, Management Accounts Committee noted the Management Accounts for the 11th month period ending 28th of February 2017 and agreed that a report be brought back from said director on the performance of the directorate for the year. Item 14, Newry Leisure Centre, Phase 2 contract compensation events, agreed on the proposal of Councillor Doran, seconded by Councillor Burgess, to note the contents of the officer's report and approve the recommendations as detailed at section 3.1 of report. 1. To provide a security barrier on the east side of the Phase 2 building at the cost sent out in the officer's report. To provide a fire suppression system in the cooker canopy in the kitchen at the cafe at the cost set out in the officer's report. To change the block work balustrade for the main stair B in Phase 2 to a metal balustrade at the estimated additional cost set out in the officer's report. Item 15, Greenway Phase 1 project, Newry to Weir on Middlebank. Agreed on the proposal of Councillor Clark, seconded by Councillor Ruan, to note the contents of the officer's report and to approve the following recommendations as detailed in section 3.1 of the report. 1. To carry out further works along Middlebank, mainly relating to health and safety measures as detailed in the officer's report, as part of the Greenway Phase 1 contract at the total cost set out in the officer's report, which would result in a project overspend on the contract figure detailed in the officer's report. 2. The cost of these works to be paid from funding allocated to the project by the Landfill Community Fund. Item 16, Newry Civic Centre update, agreed on the proposal of Councillor Ruan, seconded by Councillor Doran, to agree the contents of the officer's report and to approve the recommendation in Section 3 to appoint the company named as a value for money service. Item 17, report on staff restructuring, agreed on the proposal of Councillor Burgess, seconded by Councillor Walker, to agree the contents of the officer's report and to approve the recommendations in Section 3.1 of the report to proceed with the two redundancies identified. Thank you very much, folks. Safe home.